I'd like to read to you something which Ram Dass wrote years ago. It's entitled Man's Supreme Quest. Man's supreme quest lies in his researches into the realm of the soul, the spirit, and God. The deeper he dives into the abyss of truth, the more wonderful grows his experience. He finds worlds are involved in worlds. As he progresses inward, subtler and subtler are the planes of existence he meets. As he passes through them, he beholds supernatural visions of the divine form. He hears the sweetest strains of celestial music. He senses the intoxicating fragrance of heavenly aromas. He is dazzled with the flashes of immortal radiance. He experiences unutterable rapture of pure bliss, and at last, reaching the utmost confines of the soul in the inner world, he plunges into the infinite expanse of ecstatic silence and immutable peace, wherein everything is naught, wherefrom everything emanates. Further journey ceases here, because now the traveler and the destination have resolved into one, as the river merges into the ocean. This transcendental experience makes the soul realize not merely an intermingling of all life and existence, but also the absolute oneness of all visible and invisible worlds of manifestation. Now he feels both his physical and cyclical being in all its aspects is utterly divine, as also the vast phenomena of nature before him. The ecstasy and the light of the divine fill every pore of his body, and every atom of his physical frame responds to the thrills of delight originating from his immortal spirit, which is now one with the cosmic soul and the great basic ultimate Godhead, who is all-inclusive and all-transcendent. Love now blossoms in his heart like a full-grown flower. The world is a playground for his liberated spirit. His bliss and freedom passes all description. Childlike innocence pervades his entire being. Divine splendor illumines his face. He rolls in ineffable ecstasy. He knows he is immortal. When we find such a description of this, as this, of the realization of God, it seems very strange that we should hesitate even for a moment to do whatever is necessary to attain this high state of consciousness of being. Years ago, and maybe many of you have read it also, I read a book written by Lloyd Douglas, I think it was, called The Magnificent Obsession. And this was a story of a doctor who was constantly helping people. No matter what their need was, he helped them. He helped them in his doctoring. If they needed money, if they needed service of any sort at all, he helped them. And he required but one thing from them as a payment for his help. And that is that they would never mention anything that he did for them or gave them to anyone else. And he made them take a vow with regard to this, because he said that this was his way of storing up the power of God within himself. And he did these things, and he didn't want to dissipate his energy, his gifts that he was giving in the name of God. This went on for years, and many people were able to have college educations, many were able to pay debts, many were able to have operations or to get medical care that they needed. Many of the hungry people were fed, and this man's reputation grew as a doctor and as a man, and still everyone kept their vow, and the real truth of the matter was not known. But such love as this man received, you couldn't believe. Finally, at the time of his passing, all of this came out, and one after another came forth and told his wife and his family in testimony of all of the wonderful things that he had done, that he had actually changed the lives of many. Now, this was called a magnificent obsession, the obsession that if he gave his arms, without talking about them in the marketplace. That he went about his work quietly, silently, just doing everything he could in the name of God. That he would be filling up his spiritual storehouse of abundance. And so he did. He became a great man of God and a great man in the eyes of the people. We expend so much of our energy, you see, for our selfish selves. And we think so little of our neighbors. We think always first of ourselves, which of course we must do from the standpoint of the ego consciousness, I am. And I must think of myself before I can think of anyone else in relation to myself. But nevertheless, we want to make sure that everything is all right with us first before we think about the other fellow's needs or about his problems. And this is definitely not the way of the cross and the Christ. Because he gave everything that he might serve the God in every man. Even his life he gave. And when we say that he gave his life, we mean that he gave his consciousness of a personal life which was separate from God, but which had to be paid for in a most tremendous way. In other words, through the crucifixion of his human ego on his own cross, which was the body. Everyone here has a magnificent obsession. You have the obsession that you want God realization. This is a constant thought and a constant prayer and a constant crying out in the hearts of many. Now, not everyone is willing to make the effort to attain that which they say they desire. As I've told you before, the word gospel means to me God's spell. It is a spell that God puts upon his own people when they at last turn their faces toward him and go within and try to seek him. It is a wonderful obsession. I am so obsessed with my love for God myself that there is nothing that he would require of me that I would not do. It doesn't make any difference what it is. Night and day I think of him. Night and day I serve him. There isn't anyone or anything that I wouldn't give up for his name's sake. And I have proven this many times in my life. I've even left my own family to go and sit at the feet of a master in a far country that I might find God realization. And in doing so, I was told that I had to give up all of the desires, the attachments that were entailed in all the possessions and the people that I had left behind. And with everything I had, I tried to throw these things in the ocean of God. Now, when I came out of this, I found that I had an even greater love for my children. I had lost my attachment to the world, but I had an even greater love for my children than I had before. And so, having listened to Swami Ram Dass speak many times about how he had given up his wife and his child, and that he had no feeling except that they were filled with God and he saw them as one with himself, but I mean, there was no personal attachment. I was quite concerned about this. So I went to Papa and I told him all about this. Ah, yes, he said, I see you have this tremendous mother love within you. Well, he said, if you cannot detach yourself from that love, then you must learn to see them all as God. Well, this I could do very easily, as long as I didn't have to give up the feeling of love that I had for them. Through the years, I can't say that I don't have attachment to my children, but I have attachment to all of my children, of which all of you are included, one not more than the other. It is a personal thing, and yet it is an impersonal thing in the divine. It is the love of a mother for her child. And yet, strangely enough, most of the time I feel only like your child and your servant, regardless of seeming appearances. I feel helpless, you see, in the midst of all of this which God has put me into. I really do. You wouldn't think this when you listen to me get up and speak, but it is really true. And I know that I of myself am nothing. and that it is only by turning myself over in every single detail, of letting God use this form which he made, of letting him think through it, speak through it, act through it, that what he wills for all of you is going to come forth from this form. As you know, I stand or I sit before you twice a week, and very seldom I read something out of a book, but I rarely ever look at a note that I have made in advance. That is because I come totally unprepared insofar as anything that I personally feel that I should be giving you. Now, many times he directs me to think a thought. Like the other night, well, it was a week or so ago, I gave a sermon on what is God realization. And it so happened that I didn't have a thought in my head about it when I went to bed. I had had a very rough week, and the body was exhausted. So I set the alarm clock, and I was going to get up very early the next morning and meditate and think about a sermon that God wanted me to give. In the middle of the night, he woke me up. And just as clear as you hear my voice, I heard his voice saying, "The subject of your talk tomorrow should be, what is God realization? This is the truth." And so he gave me the sermon. Then I dash madly through the Bible, seeing if I can find something in concordance that will accord with the subject that he has given me. Sometimes I sort of reach for it, but it doesn't really seem to matter, because I read the chapter, and sometimes I take it just verse for verse all the way down the line, and other times I just take off on the subject itself. But you have a chapter read to you out of the Bible every single week, without exception. Be it related or be it not related, it doesn't seem really important. The only thing that is important is that we gather together here in God's name, that we are lifted up in his spirit, that we seek to make ourselves ever pure in order that we may realize our oneness with him, that we may really get into this magnificent obsession to the point where it absorbs every particle of our lives, every particle of our beings, until there exists for us nothing but God everywhere. What a tremendous experience this is, as Ram Dass has described, when you go within the sanctuary of your own soul and you meditate. You know, so many are slacking in this. They are not only slacking in it, but they are, slack in it, but they are lacking in it, because they don't make the effort to organize their lives, to set themselves up a schedule whereby they will think of God with their first thought in the morning as they awaken and open their eyes, and that he is the last thought that they go to sleep with at night. That one who is the center of their being, the sum total of everything that they ever wanted or dreamed of. Do you not realize what you keep yourselves from when you fail to do the things that are necessary to take God into your life, to make him an integral part of every part of it? You would have the master who would guide you, who would lead you, who would direct you in everything that you would do, who would speak to you as he speaks to you through me, without any preparation, without any thought on your part. He would walk before you, and he would light your way, and he would make all of the crooked paths straight. But how many really go to work at that? How many would rather think about what they don't have and what they want in a worldly sense, rather than think of the limitless joys of the kingdom of heaven, of the Spirit of God himself? Know ye not that ye are God's? When are we going to awaken and live up to this wonderful reality, which is our real selves? This little self that is constantly thinking only of itself, what it can accumulate, what it can draw to itself, how it can get this one or this job or whatever in the way of attachments or possessions. How many times do we spend our time thinking of those things rather than with a pure thought of God? in our heart, in our consciousness, on our lips, giving praise for all of the great blessings that He gives us. Do we not realize that as we give, so shall we receive? And so if we give thanks for everything that comes to us, regardless of its seeming appearance, whether it be pain or suffering or so-called evil or anything that opposes us, as well as for all of the tremendous, wonderful, bounteous things of life. If we gave praise for those things, that we would multiply our good 1,000 times, and we would see in all of the adversities that come within our jurisdiction that God was being so good to us because He was giving us the experiences necessary to help us to grow into the consciousness of our oneness with Him. That every tough thing we had to meet and face and overcome was a testing point. It was something that would help us to gain power and strength within ourselves so that we would be better equipped to meet the next obstacle on the path. And do we not realize that every experience, no matter what it is that comes to us, makes our consciousness expand, that we learn something new. And we grow a little each time we learn. We even learn from the things that are not good. Especially do we learn from those things. Not when everything is all comfortable and happy and cozy, but it is the tough experiences from which we truly learn. I was thinking the other day and thanking God greatly that He had not answered every prayer in my life. That seems a strange thing to thank God for, but it is true. I thank Him for the refusal to answer all of the prayers that I sent up, because some of them, as I went along this human path, were certainly things that would have burnt me through the fires of my own desires. Looking back at that now, I see that that is true. I see that it is true. But then I didn't see it. And I wondered why God didn't answer my prayer. And I thought to myself, what is the use of praying if prayers are not answered? But you see, deep in my heart, whether it be subconsciously, unconsciously, whatever, was the greater prayer of wanting perfection in all things. Of wanting peace, of wanting happiness, of wanting fulfillment, of wanting contentment. And He heard that greater prayer rather than the human prayer that would have given me something that wouldn't have lasted or would have been bad for me. He heard that greater prayer, and He answered in His own way. He answered by refusing me. He answered by giving me something sometimes that I didn't want, something that I had to do that I didn't want to do. And He made it just as difficult for me as He could possibly make it. And then He poured it on some more. And I thank Him for everything that He has done for me in that connection. It is like the Master said, that for every psychological blow that His guru had given His ego, He was eternally grateful. And that is exactly the way I feel about the things that I have gone through. You see, my guru was so easygoing with me. Why, I'll never know. He was only disturbed with me once, and that was when he wanted me to start a center, and I had been paralyzed, and I thought I had every single reason not to start this center up here, even though he had requested it of me. And so I was in bad shape physically, being paralyzed naturally. I worked out of it gradually, but he had saved my life, you see, and here I was, dragging my feet, not doing what he had asked me to do. So I happened to go down to Hollywood, and I came before him. He didn't say one single word to me. He didn't have to. I was so tuned in with him that I got the full vibration of his displeasure with me. And I started stuttering all over the place and explaining to him why I hadn't started the center. He said not one word in answer. I want to tell you that the first day I got back to Seattle, I took means, ways and means of getting the center started. And it wasn't long before I could write to him and tell him that this work was started up here. And then my conscience was relieved and I was back in his good graces again. We ask and ask and ask of God. We ask of the Christ. We ask of the Guru. But what do we give in return? We must ask ourselves that. And you know, God, Christ, and the Guru are satisfied with nothing less than everything you have to give. That seems a big demand, doesn't it? But it's the truth. Because when they say that, when they think that, when they demand that of you, they are demanding the utmost in human surrender, in the lack of human attachment, in the lack of your attachment to possessions, to people, to things. Why? Not to punish you, not to take you away from your family or from your friends, but to take you away from this little tiny self that has no basis in truth, that thinks of itself as separate from God, and to make you realize who and what you are in God. And the truth is that you and your Father are one this moment. It cannot be otherwise when God is all there is, and everything in this creation and the worlds beyond all emanate from Him, live in Him, continue in Him, and there is no stopping it, no dying in it, because He is infinite and eternal. And in taking everything and demanding everything from you, they want you to be as a piece of clay, so that they as a sculptor may mold you in the image and likeness not of themselves, but of the God, the indwelling presence within you, so that you may become that radiant self, so that you too, like this article, may be lifted up, and that you may feel this bliss and hear this celestial music and smell the fragrance of the infinite. All of these things are part of the spiritual experience, and we settle for perfumes that we buy out of a bottle. We settle for music that we pick up any place that somebody else has gotten out of the ether. And believe me, not all of it is good. Whatever we do with the gifts that God has given us, we must make sure that we express them in the utmost of, in the spiritual sense, that by hearing them, by seeing them, by listening to them, by reading them, that man's mind will be uplifted. I once wrote an article, and I entitled it, "Are We Gathering Jewels or Junk?" Because there is so much in the world today, so much garbage that is being written, that is being given forth in music, in art, in every type of existence, that it is high time we took a good look at the things which attract us, the things that we hug to our bosom, the things that we spend our time and concentrate our minds and our attention upon and use our energy with. What is it buying us? Is it buying us the things that will not rust, that will not disappear, the eternal things of the Spirit, the only things we can take with us when we go? Or is it keeping us earthbound? Are we becoming degenerate in many cases because of the things that we put into our minds and our bodies, the things that we use our lives for or misuse them? We have to think of these things. We have to have the courage to face ourselves and ask ourselves a question and give ourselves an honest answer as to just where we are going. It is high time that we made a blueprint for our happiness for ourselves. It is high time that we got this magnificent obsession within our consciousness, within our hearts, to the degree that nothing or no one can disturb it. You know, you're never going to accomplish anything if you're 50-50 about something. Like I happen to know somebody who wants to give up a very bad habit. That's become the magnificent obsession, only it isn't very magnificent, I can assure you. And one part of this individual wants with everything within them to give this up. And the other part, the human self, the little ego, the Antichrist, wants to hang on to it with everything there is. The desire for that is equal to the other desire. Now, such a one is in a terrible state. And they can't sit on the fence all the rest of their lives, because if they don't make a decision, the day is going to come when they're going to get tired sitting on that fence and they're going to fall over either one side or the other. And it is conceivable they may fall over on the wrong side and spend the rest of their lives regretting that. It is so easy to do the wrong thing. People say it is so difficult to follow the path to God, the spiritual path, to do the few things that are necessary in order to attain their realization. But my God, did they ever think of the difficulties they are building for themselves in the things that they do that are not spiritual? How they're destroying themselves, body, mind, and souls. How they're refusing to use the gifts which God has given them so that they may become a greater expression of Himself, that they may change a world, not only their own lives, but a whole world. Do you not realize, each and every one of you, that you have the potential for becoming a master within you? Now, when we say a master, we're not speaking that you have jurisdiction over other people. My master never said that. I remember when Dr. Lewis said something to him about his being the great master, the great guru. Master looked at him very humbly and he said, God is the master. God is the supreme guru. We are all his disciples. And this is the way it is, because it is God alone who is the supreme guru, the supreme master. But we have the ability within ourselves to master our human selves. This self which doesn't amount to the powder to blow it up. And to become master of that means to become purified in God, to become radiant in Him, to be successful, to be fulfilled, to extend the things that you can do beyond this little narrow world. We drain our bodies, our minds, and our souls because we worry so much about the things that we aren't able to accomplish. We go around in a vacuum. It's like we're in the midst of a whirlpool and we can't get out, we can't swim out of it. And it sucks us down in. And it uses up our physical energy. And then we wonder why we don't have the energy to do all of the things that we want to do. It is because we haven't turned ourselves over to God completely enough. And when I say completely enough, that means the whole thing. Every part of you has to be laid at the feet of God. All that you call yourself, all that you call your own, your family, your friends, your loved ones, your possessions, your gifts, everything should be laid at the feet of God if you want this tremendous experience, if you want to really see that this obsession is the most magnificent thing in the world and that you really never lived before you became obsessed with this spell of God. Somebody wrote me a letter recently and said they'd been talking to somebody that they loved, and this one asked them because of their great love for God in this form. If I had hypnotized them, it's the last thing in the world that I would ever do. In fact, I wouldn't know how. I don't believe in hypnotism, with one exception, and that is, as I have mentioned before, if somebody has had something happen to them which would keep them alive, and yet they would be like a vegetable for the rest of their lives, if something in the way of a hypnotic influence given by a doctor or some person who is qualified and who has only good intentions in doing this would help this individual to regain normal consciousness and to live a normal life, yes. Otherwise, I do not believe in hypnotism. I do not believe in having power over any other human being, nor permitting any other human being to have power over me and my consciousness, because I am responsible for my destiny in God. And if I were to turn myself over to someone else who had the power to hypnotize me, once being under the spell of that one's influence and consciousness, then it has been known to happen where these people can take hold again, whether you're with them or not, and put you into that state and make you do things that if in your conscious state you would not do. If I hypnotize you, it is with the Spirit of God, because I wish to give you that. I wish to saturate you with it. I wish to fill you so full of it that you are so entranced by it that it acts like such a magnet that you cannot possibly draw away from it. If you want to call that hypnotism, yes, from that standpoint. But not from the standpoint of my doing something over someone else's mind. In fact, I had a tremendous argument with one of the great masters that I met in India the last time, the Master Madhupaga, which means mad for God. And this was the little saint who had been on a fast for 47 days, and who the night I first met him, I'd never heard of him before, broke his fast for me. When I came in the room, he held my hand. He insisted that I sit down alongside of him. And he kept saying to me constantly, "I've never seen anything like you. I've never seen anything like you." And I didn't know what he meant at all. And I said, "Baba, what do you mean?" And he said, "When you came through that door," he said, "the light that you brought with you was so great that it blinded me." Well, I didn't know I had a light. But he had been on a 47-day fast. He had been starving the body in order that the spirit might work a little better. Maybe he saw something that I didn't know was within me. In any case, he broke his fast. And so from then on, he started eating. His body was totally emaciated. He was just skin and bones. But we had a wonderful evening together. And I remember that the nurse who took care of him couldn't speak a word of English. But somehow, she had gotten caught up in the spiritual experience that was going on in that room. And when I finally left, she came and put her head on my feet and went into samadhi directly. And they had to lift her off and take her away. Now, I didn't do any of this thing. I didn't even know why it happened. But if God in this form attracted this woman in this way and gave her this experience, it was no glory of mine as an individual. None whatsoever. Anyway, I saw him again. The next time I saw him, he was fully clothed and he'd broken his fast, but he didn't eat very much. And so we had quite a conversation. And he made the statement that it was his responsibility to work on the minds of his disciples, that he actually went to work on them in silence, in order to change their minds and spiritualize them and take them to God. And I argued with him that he had no right to do this without their sanction. That if they had come to him and said, "I put my life in your hands, do with me as you will." This is one thing, but he shouldn't have accepted it in the sense that he was accepting it, even if this had been true, because the true teacher would put the responsibility back on the disciples' shoulders, because it is their God realization they have to attain. Yes, the guru should have implicit obedience, this is true, but for one reason. It is that in giving the guru implicit obedience of taking the truth which is taught by that one and applying it as fully as possible into your own lives, that you are but preparing yourself for the day that will surely come at some time, in some lifetime, when you have to obey the will of God totally, when you have to give up your own separate will and lay it at the feet of God if you want your final emancipation, your final realization. That's the only reason the guru does it, to help you. Not because they want a personal following, not because their ego demands that you give this to them as an individual. It is for your sake. It is for your sake. So we argued back and forth, and he said he did have the right. I said he didn't. I said, if they come to you, then you can at least help them to the degree that God directs you to inside. They have given you this authority. If they write to you and tell you, but for you to do this on your own, you are interfering with their life, with their own free will, with their ability to function in a natural state, in a natural way, on the way to their own God realization. Now, if that sounds like hypnotism, then I hypnotize. But we argued back and forth and back and forth. Finally, he came over and he sat alongside of me. Neither one of us had given in. He put his arm around me and he said, "You are the Divine Mother." I said, "No, Baba, I am nothing. It is God who is all things." You are the Divine Mother. I said, I am merely His child and His servant. I went one step farther for His benefit. He said, I say you are the Divine Mother. I said, all right, Bob, if you want me to be the Divine Mother, I'm the Divine Mother. I say so, he said. Why argue with him? I know what I felt. I hadn't changed my mind, but neither one of us were getting any place. We had come to an impasse, so I gave it all to God. After all, it's His show. He is the Divine Father, the Divine Mother, and all of us, and beyond. But these little things that happen are very interesting to talk about. I was reading one of the transcripts of things that had happened many years ago with my own guru when he first came to America. He really had a rough time because he used to wear this ochre-colored robe just as he had done in India, and at that time he wore a turban around his head also. And this was many years ago, about 25 from 75, it's 50 years ago. And believe me, the teachings of the East weren't accepted then as they are today. People threw eggs at him, they threw rotten tomatoes at him, they talked about him, they reviled him, they persecuted him, they spit upon him. One day he was walking along the street, and there were some women walking behind him, and they were making fun of him. And he knew this, so he turned right around and he faced them. And he said, you know, I am very sorry to hear you speak of me in this manner because I am a stranger to your country and your customs. I had always been told that the people of the West were a very generous-hearted and good people. He said, I had hoped that that's what I would find when I came to this country. That was all he said. And the women hung their heads in shame. He had so many things to combat that we today who are on this path don't have to combat. So many different things. There's story after story that is told. I remember one time that he sat opposite a movie star. He was on a train, and the movie star was very upset because this man in this ochre-colored robe and turban was sitting across from him. And Master said that he could read his every thought. And he thought to himself, well, here am I, a great movie star, and I have to sit across the aisle from or across the way from somebody like that. So Master said, I'm very sorry that you feel the way that you do. The man looked at him. What do you mean? He said, you don't want me to sit here. He said, I annoy you. You don't think I'm good enough to sit across from you. But he said, I want to tell you, you may be a great movie star. You may think you're very great inside. But I have something that I could give you, which is much greater than anything you have or anything you will ever have. The man looked at him. He said, what could you give me? He said, I can give you God. And the man looked at him. He said, you have to be mad. He said, yes, I am. I'm mad with God. Wouldn't you like to join me? He told these stories of himself years ago. And I remember another time that he was walking down the street. He was taking some of the boys to some movie that he thought it was all right that they could see, because he realized the advantage and the necessity for a balanced way of life. He wasn't just one way. They have tried since his passing make him in the image of the Christ, so to speak, to take all of the humanness out in many ways and just make you see the divine. And he was divine, make no mistake about that. The fact that I am here living, able to speak to you, certainly is definite proof of that, because as I've told you, he's saved my life not once but many times. He's performed miracles upon miracles, not only for me, but for many others that I have seen. But anyway, he was walking down the street with this group of boys, and Bing Crosby was walking in the opposite direction. And here was Master with his robe and his turban on. And Bing came along and he looked at him. He says, hi, Dad. So he told this story about himself, too. It's a strange thing, you know, all of the things that a man of God, particularly a man from the Far East, had to go through in those days. But he went on. He was put in jail, he was accused falsely, and when the person who had committed the crime confessed finally that Master had not been the one, and they had asked him if he wanted to prosecute this individual, he said no, he didn't want to. He went on and he did good for people. And he worked for God day and night, day and night. I can testify to this because many times when I was down there, I wasn't down there many times, but of the times I was down there, many of those times, I had the room directly below his study, and the windows were open because it was always warm down there when I went down. And I could wake up at any time of the night, and Master was interviewing somebody. Sometimes he was interviewing some of the disciples that lived in Mount Washington, and they didn't like the interview very well because he was really letting them have it because they weren't living up to what they should live, what he thought they should be as disciples. But he went on to serve God. And he gave of himself and everything he had. And when he passed on, I saw the copy of his will myself. All he had was one wristwatch, a money clip, and one other little thing. I've forgotten what it was. Those were his sole possessions in this whole universe. Everything was under the name of the organization to be used for God. Every tiny thing. And yet God gave him everything he needed. And because he had given himself totally to God, this great man who loved God more than he loved himself, who gave up the idea of marriage, of having any personal life of his own, any personal possessions, in order that he might serve God in other people. Today, his name and his work is known all over the world. And there are not only hundreds, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands in every country in this universe that know of him, know of his teachings, and many are following those teachings and meditating and going to God in accordance with those teachings. This is what you can do for God. This is what you can do for yourself. It's a strange life you lead when you give up everything for God. And yet it's the fullest, the richest, the most wonderful, the most satisfying life that anyone could possibly imagine. It's difficult because you get so much opposition. The people that you try to help the most are the ones that many times turn and rend you. The ones that you think you can depend on are the ones who let you down more than anybody else. And you talk to them, you love them, you're infinitely patient with them, and they resist every God-blessed thing you try to do. And sometimes it gets a little wearing, you know. And you think, why am I in this? You know, what am I accomplishing? And then the next moment, you'll get a beautiful letter or a telephone call, or somebody will come and they will say, I thank God that I met you because you have changed my whole life. Then it's worthwhile. But regardless of if you didn't get one of those, the truly God-realized soul can't do anything else but do the will of God, to serve him in accordance with that will every moment of their lives. Because they no longer have a life of their own. They no longer have a self which they call their own. And they are content that this is so. Because when they aren't, they find it satisfying because they love God more than they love themselves. That the marriage they have with him, the love affair, the romance that they have with God is so infinitely blissful that whenever they choose, they can rise above this world of duality and be in the bliss of their consciousness, their union with him within themselves. They are like Jesus said, when he went up into the mountain of his own being, they're lifted up. They turn their eyes to the hills. And they live in another world. And they get recharged. They get re-energized and energized. And they're able to carry on. And you know, for these individuals, these situations that come that are distasteful, that are difficult to deal with, there are the rewards in an opposite way that are so much greater because you have the satisfaction of innocence within yourself. You have the knowledge of purity within your own being. You don't have a conscience that bothers you because you've done something that is not in accordance with God's laws. You're not fighting this little self every moment, deciding whether it should do this that it wants to do or whether it should go the other way, which you know to be the right way. They are totally surrendered, and only God works through that form. And they sit in the midst of their temples as a witness to everything that he does through them, and for them. And his bounty, his generosity, the wonder and the beauty and the radiance of the life that he brings and unfolds before them, so greatly more than compensates for anything they have to go through that it is unbelievable. The people that do these other things, that resist, that aren't dependable, that slack away, they are the ones who punish themselves. They do not punish the guru. They punish themselves. And yet, because the guru has such a great heart, that one sometimes weeps, but not for themselves, but for those who fall by the wayside, for those who haven't got the stability, who haven't got the balance, who haven't got the desire, the intensity of desire, to keep their feet on the path and stay with it no matter what happens, to keep coming, to keep meditating, to keep doing until they reach their goal. Because I don't care what goal you have set for yourself in this life or in any other life, you will never reach it unless you put every bit of effort into it that is absolutely necessary to attain the perfection of that goal. You can't be a scientist until you study the lessons, until you absorb all that you should know about the workings of science. You must know this. You must learn the formulas. You must learn what is necessary in order to become that scientist. If you're a musician, you must find this music within yourself, and you must express it. Now, some people are gifted this way without lessons. We have some in this group with whom this is so. And it is beautiful and it is wonderful. And God gives us as a gift. But also we must remember that those who come with such gifts must have had it before. But if you're going to graduate to the point where you can take calculus, you certainly must have had the necessary math that goes before it. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do it. So in any phase of your life, no matter what you want to do, you have to equip yourself to do it. And why should the spiritual path, with the greatest prize of all at the end of it, be any exception to that rule? And why should you back away from that when that will give you everything to a far greater degree than anything you could choose to do in a material sense? And it will include all of the things of the material world, but in the purified sense. It is very difficult to understand sometimes why we drag our feet and why we don't push ourselves to do the things that we know we should do in God. We serve our little selves. We do not always serve those others around us. And I would like to see more of that in the group. I would like to see a getting to know each other. Not in the human sense, but in the divine sense. I would like to see you come together and meditate together, even when I'm not around, to speak of God and to sit in silent meditation, to chant. And when somebody has something wrong with them or if they need help, to always be there, ready to help. This is what the Christ taught us to do. He who would be greatest among you, let that one be the servant of all. Now, all of you are willing to serve me at any time. Many and many of you have offered, and you have given me great service. But don't forget that you must serve others as you serve me, because they too are myself, even as you are. Are we all not one in God? I remember one time, and I think I've told you about this, when one of the deputies down at the organization treated me very badly when I'd asked to go down and see the master. And I knew I was going to get to see him. And I even told my daughter that when I got down there, I went, even though I was refused. I said, when I get down there, I will have an airmail letter up here that will tell me that Master will see me. And sure enough, it was forwarded to me down in Long Beach, telling me that in spite of what this devotee had said, that he would see me, that he'd be very happy to see me and spend as much time with me as he could. And so as a result of what she did, he put her from Encinitas at the Hermitage right up in Mount Washington under his own eye. And I pleaded with him for her. I asked him not to punish her for what she did, because actually she didn't hurt me any. I was with him, so I had no animosity. And he said, I insist on doing this with her because she must learn to serve God in everyone else as she serves him in me. And this is what I want for all of you. All of you. To see God in one another. To love one another. As the Christ loved you. He gave his life for you. And he will do that within each and every form that sits before me. It is this human life which the Savior gives within each and every one of us. On our own cross. That takes us into the state of Christhood, if we but knew it. It is that one which must come to that hour where he no longer exists, where that one must die if that eternal one is to be born and realized within our own consciousness, within our own hearts. There is no other way. This is the way of the cross and the Christ. We are all Christians, or rather Christians. We are all Catholics, not Roman Catholics, but Catholics in the sense that we believe in the universal Christ, whose consciousness, whose power, whose energy is in every atom of space, in every single form that this earth holds. Everyone. That is the true meaning of the word Catholic. And that we are. You know, the Bible is wonderful because it sets forth the full way that the human soul must go. Not just one who went that way, but that every human soul must go if they are to reach this tremendous state of divinity, of the realization of your oneness with God. It is all laid out for you. If you would read the scriptures and meditate upon them, and do everything that is asked of you, these experiences would come to you, not in a terrible way, but in a gradual way, because God never gives any of his children more than they can handle. Never. When they turn their hearts to him in full surrender, he will certainly do everything he can to help them, because he will work with them. They are working with him, and he has made this perfect law. It is the law itself, which is neither this way or that, but it is our use of that law that makes the difference between crime and punishment and eternal reward and happiness. This is the truth. And when we realize this, when we make the effort, when we go within our secret temple and shut all the doors, close them very tight, and commune with the blessed Lord who dwells within, we find peace and joy and happiness and all knowledge within ourselves to a degree that in the human sense we just would not and could not believe. But you've got to make the effort. You've got to do it. I have begged you, I have pleaded with you, I have loved you, I have spanked you occasionally. I've done everything but stand on my head. And I'm a little old to do that now. But anyway, if I could, I would. But I do it mentally, trying to help you to help yourselves. That's all I can do. That's all I can do. I want you so filled with this magnificent obsession that there is nothing else in this life for you but God. And that everywhere you look, every form that you see, every voice that you hear, every sound, every movement is of him. And the time will come when your hearts will be lifted up like you run like the wings of a bird, and you will soar into the heaven of your heavenly Father, and you will be with him in his eternal blissful state forevermore. This doesn't mean that you will die, that you will disappear. It means that for the first time you will know what life is. You will be that. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.